Hello, everybody. Kind of special edition of the Baseball America Draft Podcast this week because we're a little bit late coming out with this. We were busy yesterday. News obviously broke yesterday at baseballamerica.com that MLB has made a rather significant, I would say a very expansive, sweeping proposal to completely overhaul amateur talent acquisition. I would put it that way, because there's the draft, domestic draft, and changes to that. There's a proposal for an international draft. There's changes to eligibility rules. There's changes to signing bonuses and a significant reduction in that. And we wanted to, on this episode of the podcast, kind of look through all the kind of the different avenues of this. Carlos spent much of the afternoon texting and talking to scouts and front office officials. Later on the show, we'll have Jacob Rudner. We'll be talking. You know, we're going to cover this from all the different areas. But Carlos, great to see you as always. And kind of just to jump straight into it, you talked to a lot of people yesterday. There's a piece up at baseballamerica.com where you'll get even more of this. But if you were going to summarize the overall reaction to this, whereas when I talked to Jacob, college coaches are like, hey, this sounds great. Every high school prospect in the country goes to college.
Yeah.
Sign me up.
Yes.
And I would say front office officials may have a little bit more skepticism about this proposal.
Yeah, I would say the general takeaway from most of the people that I talked to, and I do want to say most because there is some outlier opinions, but the general sentiment was one of overwhelming negativity and a view that this would be bad for baseball. Professional baseball, obviously, when I'm talking about baseball, I think the scouts acknowledge it would be good in terms of sending talent to college. But the view that I got expressed to me really consistently was there's a lot of skepticism about offloading player development to college baseball. There's a lot of frustration with the idea that the league wants to prevent teams from developing players and choosing the sorts of players they might want to take chances on. There is this confusion from scouts kind of wondering who of the ownership group even wants this change, because there is a sentiment that drafting high school players is actually an area where small market teams can compete. And so I'd say it was very negative in general. There's also a sense that it's just unrealistic. And I think there is still some hope from scouts that this won't actually come to pass or happen, but that is kind of my broad takeaway on how scouts reacted to this proposal.
Okay, just if you are somehow listening to this podcast and you haven't seen any of the everything else, I'm going to give this is from the outside of the atmosphere view of this to try to summarize this in a minute. The proposal that MLB laid out would eliminate high school draftee eligibility, all players to be eligible for the domestic draft. I keep saying that because there will be an international draft in this too. The domestic draft, that's U.S. and Canada. And those players, Puerto Rico is part of the U.S. U.S. and Canada. Yeah. Also, it's the technically any U.S. island as well. So, right. Which has happened before, So any player for the domestic draft would not be eligible until 2 years after their high school class, whether they graduated or not. You don't have to have a diploma or a GED to be eligible. Mm-hmm. But that class, 2 years after it finishes, and before we've had the rule where you have to be 21 or 3 years of college, this will be, you have to be 20 by September 1st of the draft year and have had 2 years. So in the case of an Eli Willits, if Eli Willits had been in this situation, in this system, he would have to wait 3 years of college because he would not be 20 by the time of by the eligibility time. So that's the big picture thing. And then the other big picture thing that we will talk about is, and when you say, well, why would the owners be for this? One part of this proposal effectively would remove 400 between the international draft and the domestic draft. I shouldn't even say $400 million. The proposal would remove, the better way to put it is over $200 million in bonuses in current terms, right? Now, that's going to go up again. Last year, $401 million is what we had the draft spending at, and that does include non-drafted free agents, but that's part of the system, and that would be part of the system in this too.
Yeah.
So their proposal to go from $401 million in spending last year, which will be more this year, 410, 415, whatever it is, to $200 million hard slotted and in a 12-round draft. And then if you're not drafted and you want to sign, you can sign for $10,000, which is also a dramatic reduction. Basically,
correct,
less than 10% of what you can sign for right now as a non-drafted free agent.
Right, and the current limit is $150,000 until it counts towards your bonus pool.
Yes.
But yeah, so that's a significant reduction.
You could right now still sign for $175,000, $200,000 if the team had more bonus pool.
Correct.
In this scenario, it would be $10,000. What about $10,500? Do you have no, it's $10,000. There's nothing else.
Yep.
So, and that is the point I should make clear, though, that that's when I say that it would be $200 million there. That's every year, right? So the last time that the draft had spending of under $200 million, you have to go back to 2010. You have to go back to two systems ago, basically, from this proposal. And obviously, if the current system was maintained and the way that the calculations are done, it's really, that's underestimating the amount that'd be taken out of it, because obviously it's $200 million now. If you said 7 years from now, it would probably be, if again, this number is going to go up as well, but considering how low that number is, even if you said we're going to put a 8% rate of growth on it, 8% of 200 million and 8% of 400 million, you're that gap widens every year. But let's just say 200 million each year, that's $1.4 billion over the course of a CBA that mm-hmm. would be taken out of amateur bonus spending in the domestic draft. So that's a dramatic reduction. 12 rounds, hard slotted. You could trade draft picks, and there would be the draft lottery would be shortened to 4 picks from 6. Because this is part of the proposal with the cap and floor system and all that, it would also eliminate competitive balance picks. It would eliminate the distinction between lottery picks for revenue mm-hmm. payees versus payors and all that.
Right.
Again, that's the very broad strokes of it. But I think the most important thing that we should probably dive into, the most significant part of this, the thing that would be the most significant thing, I think, since the draft was instituted in 65, and I got that wrong on a video yesterday, 66, that's stupid on my part, 65, is no high school eligibility. Mm-hmm. And you'd already touched on this, but it would take what has been a steady trend, which is we went from teams would take a number of flyers on, you know, have a 40 round draft. You would take flyers on developmental high school players. We went to a 20 round draft. The Brewers are still really good at it. There are other teams who do it well.
Right.
But we saw a reduction in the number of high school players drafted. At the same mm-hmm. time, what we haven't seen is a reduction in the number, like the first 5 rounds of the draft, it's the cream of the crop, especially on the position player side, goes pro out of high school.
Yes.
Every year. And I would just lay that over to you. It's like in this, it would say, nope, those elite talents.
Right. Yeah. I think
are no longer draft eligible.
I think this is where the biggest animosity came from the scouting community, because you laid this out in a number of your, I think in your initial video that was on YouTube, about just where the elite players in the game come from, where the most expensive players in the game come from. They are players, by and large, who are signing as teenagers into pro ball, whether that's from the domestic draft, whether that's as an international free agent. They're the elite young players who are the outliers who make the major leagues as teenagers at 20, 21 years old. And then because of that, go on to hit free agency at just an unusually young age, which is then rewarded in huge free agent deals. And obviously from the team's perspective, if you're going to just artificially put a cap on players in the domestic side signing at age 20, 2 years removed from high school, qualifying for both of those, you are just basically forcing out that player profile. And I think from the scout's perspective, it's both a question of why would you want to take those elite players out of the game of baseball, out of Major League Baseball? There is some frustration that Major League Baseball would just want to give those players to college baseball. I know on the scouting side, it's like, hey, we're competing with college baseball for these players. We don't view college baseball as a a development, like an offloading the development. That's what this is about. Essentially, scouts kind of despise that because, again, they don't really trust the colleges to have the incentives to properly develop the players. There are real questions about playing time. There are questions about pitch usage and overuse for pitchers. There are all sorts of those like incentives questions on the development side. And then the other element too that I think was interesting is one scout put it to me like this, and I'll just read one of the quotes. And there are a lot of really colorful quotes in this piece I did. You tend to get that when you're soliciting quotes from scouts. One person said, "It's incredibly penny wise and pound foolish. High school players are probably the best deal in the entire sport. You look at the history of the game, Hall of Famers and All-Stars, they usually come from the high school ranks." He mentioned guys like Colt Emerson, Connor Griffin, Kevin McGonigal. Connor Griffin is probably worth $300 million on the open market. He said they're getting him for $140 million. Colt Emerson is probably worth $200 million, and he's getting $90 million in these early extensions. He said these teams aren't stupid. They are getting a good deal. So in addition to just like the frustration about not having those players in baseball, the scouts are also kind of looking around and being like, yeah, we understand it's cost savings, but like, don't you realize how valuable you're getting these players on deals? Like small market teams like the Pirates, like the Brewers, like the Rays are able to get advantages and get elite talents if they can succeed in scouting and developing these young players. And I think there is just some idea that like, just like confusion as to why you wouldn't want that.
I think it is fair to say with this that if you went to a fully college system effectively, you reduce you kind of push everyone a little bit more towards the middle, because not that there would not still be scouting, but the challenge of scout, and this is one of the things MLB said in the proposal, is this like the hit miss rate on high school players is higher than the hit miss rate on college players, which makes sense. You have pitchers get through the injury nexus of their late teenage years. You have hitters who go to college and it's like, oh, we thought that guy would develop as a hitter. He wouldn't, all that. But that's kind of at the same time, you could flip that completely around what scouts are saying and say, that's, you're taking away our skill at identifying. The Pirates identifying when not everyone was like, oh, Connor Griffin's going to really be able to hit.
Right.
There were absolutely teams out there who are like, I love all the tools, but I don't really believe in the bat.
Right.
Them identifying that and then drafting him ninth overall is one of the biggest success stories the Pirates have had in the 21st century already. Right. Like, doesn't, you know, like whatever he ends up being, like that is one of the best success stories they've had. If you push everyone to college, there are less opportunities for teams to kind of break away from the pack. But to go back to your other point, when I think it is important, and we're going to talk, we obviously talked to Jake about this too, but I would say like from a scout's perspective, I do think that another aspect of this that you really touched on is even in this, I would say that there's already a very big difference between the focus of college baseball and the minor leagues. The minor leagues is about development.
Right.
And no one gets fired. There is no such thing as a minor league manager who does a great job of developing players in a year, but they don't win. And it's like, well, I'm sorry, but we got to let you go. I know that that pitcher was really good, but you didn't win. College, those guys, you could have top talents who do not play for an understandable reason, which is, this guy's going to be great in 5 years, but I've got to win now.
Right.
And I do think a two-year window might even – before they're eligible, might even kind of compress that a little bit more, because you may not get that payoff in year three for pitching the freshman in year one.
I think there was a lot of emphasis of exactly those points about the fact that in this situation, we're asking college coaches to act in the best interest of the players. And some scouts pointed out that's not always the case, either because they're hiding players, they're redshirting them, they're limiting their exposure because they want to keep them in the program for longer, which does happen, or the fact that they are not going to be put in the best position to develop because, as you said, the way college coaches make money is by winning games. They are incentivized to put the best players on the field who can help you win today, and that is increasingly becoming 22, 23, 24-year-old college players. So there's a concern about like where the playing time is going to come from these elite players. Baseball is such a skill-oriented sport. It's not like the NFL where you can just out-athlete people. young elite players need reps, particularly hitters. They need a ton of reps. And I think there was also some pushback on the idea that if Connor Griffin, if Seth Hernandez, if these players go to college, they will necessarily follow the same path that they've taken in pro ball. That is definitely not the case. These players could easily go to college, struggle early, get more limited playing time, and then don't take the strides we saw with Connor Griffin with his swing. When he is basically hitting every single day, his full-time focus is on getting better as a baseball player. There's no classroom component. I think one other element of this as well that scouts brought up was that, and I appreciated that there were a number of college coaches Jacob talked to as well who pointed this out, but this is essentially forcing players through a college route when college is not necessarily the best path for every player. There are going to be a number of players who are not ready for the academic side of a college environment. Have no interest in it at all. I was also talking to scouts who mentioned the just players who are coming from maybe poor backgrounds who are just not going to be put in an environment where they are going to be comfortable or have success at college. An element of like black players, minority players was something that was brought up. Like, hey, in pro baseball, there are a lot of other minority players and players who come from disadvantaged backgrounds. And there is the sense that like for some of those players, that is a better environment for them both to become better as baseball players, but also develop off the field as young men. And I think there's just a lot of frustration with the idea that you're forcing an avenue that maybe is not best suited for players.
And that's, you just hit on a very interesting, like, and again, there's a lot of this that we will emphasize. This is a proposal. The MLBPA came out quite strongly against this proposal. It's possible that this will be, you know, DOA. It's possible that some aspects of this will be adopted. It's possible that, you know, a significant part of it, we don't know. If this is a marathon, we're not in the top first 5 miles
right.
of this negotiation, right? Like there is much, much to go, many, many, many miles ahead. But to your point, in a 2 years to be eligible system, but in a system also though, that's 12 rounds and really is structured to say, if you aren't, Jacob makes a point. We'll touch on this later with Jacob as well. The structure of this is one where if you aren't an elite prospect going, we don't know what the slots are going to be, but we know that if you go from last year, it was about $13.7 million per team spending in draft bonuses to $6.7 million under this for the whole draft. We know that if you get, no matter how that math works, the math only works to say that if you get to about the fifth round, your bonus amount is going to be pretty small in the world of what we've gotten used to, right?
Right.
Well, it's hard slotted. If you're a sophomore and they're like, we're going to take you in the fifth round, I could absolutely see players who are like, don't take me. I'm not going to sign. I won't sign. I've got a good gig here. And by the way, if I have a better year as a junior and you draft me in the third round, I don't get a haircut because I have less negotiating leverage than a sophomore.
Right.
It's still a hard slot. If you draft me, if you say you're going to be a fifth rounder as a junior and you say, don't draft me in the sixth round, I'm not going to sign. If you draft me as a senior, as a 22-year-old, but you take me in the third round, you don't get to give me, hey, you're a senior, here's 100K.
Correct.
You have to draft, pay that player as much as the player above him or below him who's a sophomore.
Right.
So the system as they proposed it would very much push all but the most elite prospects to stay in college. But to go to your point, I do think that there's very possible that that scenario, it doesn't mean that the LSUs of the world would not go after the Connor Griffins, the Kevin McGonigals.
Right.
However, I could 100% see a scenario where I'm trying to think of that second, that next tier, the player who right now is, let's go to the second round, the late second round, like Dean Moss, right? Mm-hmm. Like Will Hines from last year, like guys like that, Johnny Slowinski, those guys, I could see those absolutely not being the guys who get pursued, even though those are elite prospects, but being like our best way to win 34 player roster capped, not 55 to play 34 player roster. Our best way to win is going to be, we're going to have a lot more 20, 21, 22 year olds on even the best teams in college baseball, because a slightly less athletically gifted, a less tooled up 22 year old in general is probably going to help you win more games than a incredibly toolsy 19 year old.
Mm-hmm.
And that would go back to what the scouts are saying there.
Yeah. I think the other element that is interesting that I want to touch on here, when we're talking about like the scouting perspective, is like the potential impact on how scouts would operate under this system. And I think maybe the biggest point of confusion that I've seen from people who are digesting this proposal with the 20 rounds to 12 rounds, I think there is a sense that like, oh, because it's 20 rounds to 12 rounds, there will be fewer players coming from the domestic draft. And I guess we should say non-drafted scenario. But I think what was key for scouts who wanted to take a silver lining view of this proposal, which to be clear was a very outlier opinion, but I did hear it. Some scouts said, hey, the fact that they committed to not removing future minor leagues means we still need the same number of players in pro ball. And just because those players won't be drafted, you still have to sign those players. And so from the player perspective, the bonuses are obviously significantly shorter. Your non-drafted free agents go from 150 max without hitting the bonus pool to 10K. And then I did hear from some scouts who said, hey, this now makes me a difference maker for a team. When it's, hey, you're only getting 10K from every team, it's not how much money are you getting offered, it's which scouts have put in the work on the ground to communicate and educate to players and make them feel comfortable. Hey, our organization can do X, Y, and Z for you. You're going to get better in our organization. You have comfort with me as a scout and evaluator. I've been watching you for years. So there is maybe one glimmer of hope that like this could maybe add more value to amateur scouts. At the same time, I think a natural tendency from scouting departments and a number of teams would say, hey, we only have to draft 12 rounds now. We're not drafting any high school players. We've already taken a very model-heavy, analytically-heavy, video-heavy evaluation strategy for college players. There are a lot of areas that are not college-heavy. We can cut back on our scouting staffs in those areas. We can go really heavy with stats on the college side, and we'll be able to cut scouts. I think, pessimistically, that is probably the route that most teams will take.
I bring JJ's this up
showing the dollar sign on the muscle here in the background.
I know it's going to be back not watching the video, but dollar sign on the muscle. I bring that up because there is to take the positive and the negative.
Right.
On the positive side, it's 100% true. That was what scouting used to be, right?
Like, right.
Obviously, if you are an area scout in 1955 or 60 or 48 or whatever, if your team is only offering 10,000, and which, by the way, when we say 10,000 now, they were getting more than that in 1950. Like,
which just is insane.
Just to put it in perspective,
which is insane.
Like, a $10,000 bonus to try to land a top prospect or even a good draft prospect, or good prospect. What a draft! There was no draft. The draft was the Rule 5 draft. That was the only draft. The real draft was the draft. But I joke. But but if everyone was kind of similar, what they were offering.
Mm-hmm.
Often players would sign with the team of the scout who they felt a real connection to. And at that time, the scout and the player were more intertwined also from a standpoint of the scout was your advocate in the organization. Mm-hmm. As they would often meet in the off season, check in, even during the season sometimes. And mm-hmm. It's like, but in that scout was kind of like, hey, watch, you know, Johnny's really taking a step with this or whatever. Those relationships were very important. Yes, that part would be true here. That would be very much true. I think wise teams in this would obviously spend more money. They would start scouting these players in high school because you would have a much longer understanding of these players. But there would be teams who go, this is our ability to hack.
Exactly. I think the smart teams would still continue to really emphasize scouting the high school players, because again, in this scenario, the way you're evaluating your college players analytically changes pretty significantly. If you're going from most players have 3 years of track record to now it could be 2 years. Oh, also all the elite high school players are getting to college every year. That really changes the makeup of playing time in college for many players who are draft eligible. You might be looking at a single year of performance data. I think there would be a scenario where a lot of the performance data that teams are looking at gets quite a bit more noisy, and teams could have a competitive advantage by scouting up the high school players and creating really thorough backgrounds on what they were like in high school, how they've changed. If you're a team who slacked on that area and you're purely looking at a single year's performance data, it maybe is an area where you could feel comfortable but get fooled. And I know, again, some of these are like scouts looking for silver linings, hoping their organizations would be the orgs who would continue to invest in scouting. But I do think the natural takeaway of this is like, hey, if no high school players are being scouted, that is the most expensive boots on the ground requirement to scout players are the high school players compared to the college players. I do think the natural tendency would be, hey, we can shrink and save a little bit more money on our scouting staffs because there are just fewer demographics we really need to go out and hit on the ground.
The other thing that strikes me that I think would be significant in this is if you go to an all college drafty scenario system, we're going to have like, it's funny, but in that scenario, we'll actually have teams would have less wood bat data and insight than they do for the high school players. Like the high school players now, you get a pretty good summer look at best on best with the hitters hitting with wood.
Now, although wood, we maybe should put in quotation marks these days.
Yeah, well, we have
with some of the bats we have.
Yes,
but okay. But correct.
In general, unless you know, as long as you're not using a wood
composite. This, like there is a significant difference in evaluating a pure hitting ability of a hitter with metal bat versus wood bat. The margin for error, barrel feel, you don't get a great sense of that, and you can be fooled oftentimes with college performance given the offensive environment in college baseball and just how different hitting is with a metal bat versus a wood bat. I think people intuitively know like the ball goes further off a metal bat, but there are far more mishits who are hit for home runs, doubles, triples into the gap in college with metal bats that you will not have. You will be more punished with wood bats, and I think being able to get a feel for that pure hitting ability will be more challenging if you're only looking at college players with metal bats.
But I want to make this point. It used to be you would say, oh, that's not a problem. That's what the summer's for.
Yep.
But I just said the words best on best. There is almost, other than USA baseball a little bit, there's very little best on best where top tier pitchers are facing top tier hitters with wood bats. Because, and by the way, in a world that still has free transfers and now 2 years of eligibility before draft eligible, I would say even more so, like we hear all the college coaches now say, there is no possible incentive that makes sense for me to encourage, especially my pitchers, to go play summer ball. Mm-hmm. If your pitcher goes play summer ball, you kind of know that your chances of that pitcher coming back on campus, and I do not care what program we're talking about, they go down. Now, there may be a push-pull where players are like, I'm still going to go play college summer ball because maybe I'm going to put a price tag.
This gets exactly back to the initial point of like, this is the player development system you want to push every player to, a system that disincentivizes players going out and playing with wood. It's not a great look for developing hitters, for developing arms who need more reps. It's just not.
It did strike me this year. We have a draft this year where, and maybe it's just you push back. You know the draft for us every year. I cannot remember a year where I feel like that we have less wood bat record with the top hitters in the class.
I think that's true.
There is like it used to be, like we are not that far removed from where if you said, oh, okay, what's their wood bat record? And it would be like, this is what they hit in the Northwoods League after their freshman year. This is what they hit in the Cape in their sophomore, mm-hmm. After the sophomore year. And now here they, and here's what USA baseball time as well.
Right.
And also when you saw that, you knew that that was against, oh, okay.
And good arms, high quality pitchers.
Those were high quality arms. Now it's like, this is what they hit in their 1 week in the mm-hmm. Cape. This is what they hit in their week at USA right. baseball. And by the way, well, what did they hit against in the Cape or in the Northwoods League? And it's like pitchers who will not play at major programs, will not get on the mound at major programs during the fall, during the spring, because yeah. that's the pitchers who are now allowed to go. The pitchers who are allowed, who are encouraged to go to summer ball now are the ones who either A, they are so far away from contributing that you're like, the risk is worth the reward if they mm-hmm. develop. And B, it's players who are going somewhere else and need to showcase themselves to get those offers. Mm-hmm. But the amount of like, oh, I saw a first round arm next year on the mound facing these guys with wood, that is an artifact of an earlier age.
Mm-hmm.
And there's nothing in this that would necessarily encourage changing that. And as you said, hitting with metal is not the same as hitting with wood. And
no.
And pitching to metal is not the same as pitching to wood.
No.
You do not get rewarded for sawing off a hitter coming in. Although we do see now a couple every now and then we see a bat broken.
Yeah.
But you generally there are a lot more hits on a hitter who lost the battle, but just kind of got the bat on it with a metal bat. Than there is with wood. We know this. And so, okay, we've already gone 30 minutes. What else have we not covered that was significant in your conversations?
I don't know that it was significant, but I will say almost everyone who has commented on the addition of draft pick trading is cool with it. I think that's maybe the one element of this proposal that everyone seems to be either indifferent to or have an actual positive opinion on. People seem to get excited about the idea of pick trading. So that was one kind of at the end where it was like, if you bothered to comment it, you were generally pretty okay with it. And the pick trading would obviously come with the hard slotting system that was proposed. So
that's the key point here.
I do think that like, regardless of what happens, I think a lot of this is probably unlikely to actually come to pass. I do think that there seems to be a realistic path to a hard slotting system of some capacity that includes pick trading to make the draft more, I think, approachable for fans while still retaining a lot of the ability to be strategic on your board from the team's perspective. So that maybe isn't one element of this that we'll actually be able to see in the future.
Although you just hit on it. I think, again, I don't think the MLBPA, the Players Association has no problem if there's more pick trading. I do think the MLB, its hesitance to it has always been, if it's a hard slotted system, they're fine with it. Mm-hmm. If it's not,
it does also feel like they kind of want to make sure there are some constraints on how much they would allow teams to trade. I feel like from the MLB side, there is like a hesitance of like, we don't want to be in a scenario where one team has traded like all of their first round picks for the next 5 years. So there were some constraints that they mentioned.
They want to put constraints on terrible owners.
Right.
Terrible owners, terrible GMs, like, which is a reasonable thing, because that has come about because there was a time in the NBA in the 80s where literally they had to put these rules in place because there was an ownership group. I think it was the 76ers, but I'm off the top of my head, but was like trading away all their picks for terrible players because they were idiots. And so, yes, there were restrictions on that, but to explain this out to people who don't follow it this closely, if you say, well, why do they care? Why do they not want picks to be traded generally? If you take away hard slots, their concern is that if you allow free trading of picks, that they don't want players to have a whole lot of power in the draft. Their worry is that there would be elite players who could basically put out a number in a non-hard slotted system that would help engineer certain teams to land a player rather than other teams.
Right.
And whether that is true or not, that's been their concern. And so I don't know if you would see free trading of picks. The draft system stayed as it is right now, but they're quite willing to let free trading of picks I don't know if they would be as open to it in a non-hard slotted system.
Right.
But I do think that that's something that fans, and I will say with this, the one other thing that I will say with all of this is there is an underlying part of this. Scouts understandably have a lot of concerns with this. But there is another underlying part of this, which is that I would say that MLB clearly in this also wants the MLB draft to be a bigger deal. You know, like if you say, what are their motives for this? We brought up the, you know, offshoring of development to, you know, in some ways to a entities that you do not have to pay. We brought up that, you know, this would reduce bonuses. But I also would say there is, I believe, on MLB's part of this proposal also is that they look at the NFL draft, they look at the NBA draft, and they're like, we want that. We want it to be something right. where every player who goes in the first round is much more of a household name to the average baseball fan, where mm-hmm. which we're getting there. By the way, we are getting right. there, like where players...
It feels like they are trying to grab the attention that comes with the NFL draft that is there by virtue of college football being such a dynamic powerhouse of an entertainment product. And they're just saying, oh, those drafts are college only. If we do that, we'll net the same benefits, which I think is like putting the cart before the horse in some ways. But it definitely is clear that like they think if it's just college only, it'll be more approachable. The players will be more visible. There will be a shorter ETA from all the players who are drafted to the majors. So there will be this tighter pipeline, which is true. Like if you're only drafting college players, you're going to see those players quicker at the major league level. But I do think, again, this was expressed to me as well by scouts. There's a little bit of frustration that the scouts think that MLB is just copying, pasting from a lot of other leagues when they don't necessarily think that always translates. And I think the biggest difference is obviously like for a high school football player, it is a legitimate danger to you to go from high school to the NFL, where that's not really the case in baseball.
And that's where, again, these things we don't know, but I would see that there is a certain logic to the fact that if like, again, to take the example of the guys we keep using, but if Connor Griffin was the star shortstop at LSU, who's doing these unreal things in mm-hmm. Omaha, and you're like, oh, you know, we're sitting here, we're rolling into this draft and the White Sox are picking 1-1.
Right.
And their fans are like, if we draft Connor Griffin, he's going to be our, probably in that case, center fielder maybe,
right.
or he's their shortstop and Colson Montgomery moves, whatever. But he's going to be their opening day 2027.
Right. Well, so I guess my pushback would be, is that worth losing what Pirates fans have gotten with Connor Griffin?
Do understand, the thing I will say with all of this is people keep asking me, what's your opinion on this? Mm-hmm. My job, I feel like I am a relic of an earlier age. I grew up doing this at newspapers and places like that. And my answer to that is, it is my job to try to understand every aspect of this, the pros and the cons of all of this. But I feel like my job is, if I'm reporting on this, if I'm talking to both sides, mm-hmm. it's not that I'm coming in and I'm waving the flag of one side in this and saying, you guys are great, you guys are idiots or anything. I'm trying to fairly portray what both sides are saying and then pointing out like they're saying this, mm-hmm. but they're leaving out is this as well.
Right.
And what I would say with this is that's MLB's view on this is, hey, this would make the draft more interesting. Trading of draft picks, everyone's a household name. If college baseball continues to grow, all that. To the point that you just made, it is 100% also true. And as someone, as a lover of baseball history, taking away, we talked about Connor Griffin. I'll do another one to kind of wrap up this segment. Taking away Mike Trout's Rookie of the Year, second in the MVP voting, and probably should have won the MVP year. That's, to me, that is something that losing Mickey Mantle, again, I know that that's before the draft ever existed, but losing King Griffey Jr. going from the draft to the big leagues in the blink of an eye. Alex Rodriguez. There are so many, that, and you can say these are the ultimate outliers. 100% true. At the same time, one of the most fascinating and joyous things as a baseball fan to have is when one of those comets screams through the air. And by the way, you can say, oh, you know, but Mike Trout was great for another decade. Mike Trout, like, there's something joyous and fun about the teenager, the 20-year-old who's already able to match wits with the 35-year-old veteran, because as much as you can say they're going to have a long, long, long career ahead of them, the joy of thinking of what is this player going to be? Am I watching Ken Griffey Jr.? Is this going to be one of the greats of all time? Am I watching Mike Trout? Mm-hmm. Is this going to be one of the greats of all time? Am I watching Connor Griffin? Is this going to be the greats of all time? That's different than, oh, this 22-year-old showed up. He seems like he's pretty good. Right. Even if that player has, Paul Skenes is amazing, but Paul Skenes is like the more normal progression. When Connor Griffin shows up as a teenager, when Juan Soto shows up, that's more fascinating, I think, as a baseball fan, mm-hmm. because you know how hard that is. You know how unusual that is. If you are losing something, obviously, if you take that away, in addition to, like, the one other thing I do want to point out with this is try to write this. The point is that you made early on is very true. If you keep the current big picture free agency system, if you do, and this is why the PA would be utterly understandably against this, you are taking hundreds of millions or billions of dollars out of free agency, because it is not something, this is not something where if you just push all these players back, their debuts back a year or 2 years, well, but they're still the best players in the game, so they're still going to get the same contracts. No. Mm-hmm. If you took any player in baseball right now, and you said you will be a free agent going into your age 26 or your age 27 season, and you take that same player and you say you will be a free agent going into your age 29 or your age 30 season, MLB teams will be way less interested, as they should be. They're not idiots. A 30-year-old player has much less value to give you in that free agent contract than the 26-year-old or the 27-year-old. Now, yeah. But I bring this up just to also point out, the flip side of that is, if you are doing this, if the PA was like, we think that this is a fine idea, which they did not, but if they did, it would have to come with, if you were the PA, other changes where it's like, hey, if we go to an age-based free agency system where, yes, if you get drafted as a senior and you're 23 and you reach major leagues as a 25-year-old, it doesn't really matter for you. The Whit Merrifields of the world aren't screwed anymore, because a late debuting player means you'll never hit free agency at a time where you're economically valuable. Mm-hmm. If you said we're going to be every player is a free agent when for their age 28 season, well, that would go away, right? Like, that would be then that no longer would you be able to say, oh, this is a plan that is designed to drive down salaries. There are ways that, again, every little complex piece of this changes if the system changes in other ways. Mm-hmm. That's what we don't know. So I do want to say, like, when people, like, the same way I will say this is like, okay, the other thing, I know this has gone way longer than we want it to, but
lots to talk about.
But the other thing I'll point out is you brought up the 120. For one, okay, we spelled that out like really high up in the story. That is a very significant part of this, is that MLB came out and said, they have an MILB PA collective bargaining agreement to be done in the next couple of years. And then they have the professional development license, the PDLs with MILB owners, that is set to be a negotiation. Those licenses end after 2030. And I mean, so there'll be negotiations 2030 going to go into the 2030s. They explicitly stated in this proposal that they are not going to reduce below that 120. Now, if there's expansion, it could be 128 or whatever, but they're not reducing that. They're not cutting out low A. They're not cutting out high A. They're not cutting out the FSL. They're not cutting out the Cal League, all that. They said this. And people are like, well, what do you trust them? Well, okay, I'm going to start with this. when they cut 40 teams back in 2020, they didn't hide it. They didn't say, oh, we're going to keep all the teams in the last minute. No, they said all the way through this, we're going to do this. Here's why we want to do this. They didn't, like, when you say, I don't trust them.
Right. They didn't trick you last time when they did it.
Politically, and someone then said to me, no, but I don't trust them because they also said they were going to go to the best stadiums. And they didn't go to this stadium, this complex, the new Northport complex. Like, no, the Braves didn't want to be in the FSL. They're not going to make them go to the FSL, things like that. But what I would say with all this is, by stating that publicly and explicitly, I will say politically, there could be a new commissioner, by the way, also before the 2030. Politically, it would be, other than there's another pandemic or something like that, it would be very, very difficult now for MLB to change on something that they have already said. And again, they did not do that in 2019, 2018, 19, 20. They didn't say all teams are safe and then change it. Right. They, for a year, said,
and you've been very consistent in trying to reinforce and tell people why it would be so unlikely that another minor league level would just be taken away and the reasons why it seems unlikely. So I appreciate that. And it is nice to see this, the stated intention from MLB's side here.
The one thing I will say with this that we do not know, and I think this is, to be honest, to, you know, like this is much more of a minor degree. Obviously MLB runs the complexes, the Arizona Complex League, Florida Complex League, they can reorganize that in whatever the way they want. I always talk about ticket buying minor league teams, right? If you said the ACL has just become the summer-long instructional league, we play the games, but they're not official records or whatever, the impact of that, and again, I'm not saying the MLB is going to do that. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying that's much different than saying we're going to lop off low A. And they've come out and said they're not doing that. They're not going to reduce the four levels of the minors. And it is funny how many people, you've gotten it and I've gotten it. It's like, well, that doesn't even make any sense. It's a 12-round draft. You can't do that. It's like, one, almost no one drafts and signs every player they draft right now. It happens. But the vast majority of teams draft several players 11th round on that they don't sign. So we're not talking, we're going from 20 or 22 to 12. We're going from 18 to 20 to 12. And as you said, there's no restriction here. Like,
and every year, people should look at our non-drafted free agent tracker. Most teams beyond whoever they're signing are just signing non-drafted free agents regularly. That would continue to happen. There would be more prominent players who were selected in that capacity for significantly cheaper. So yeah, the volume of players coming in wouldn't change materially under this proposal.
So, okay. I know that covered a lot. We need to wrap it up. I've got to make a phone call. I know you got stuff to do too. But that is our look at the draft. After this break, I'll come back and I will talk to Jacob and we will look at it much more from the college perspective. We'll do that right after this quick break. I'm now joined by Jacob Rudner, our college baseball expert extraordinaire. He's in Omaha. He's at the College World Series. Got to be honest, I kind of ruined his off day, his Thursday off day, because, you know, with this story, pretty much I would say that Jacob spent the entire afternoon since then talking to coaches, talking to athletic directors. But with that, I'll just basically hand it over to you. What is the feedback you're getting from coaches, you know, athletic officials? I would say that, just my guess, I've talked to a couple coaches, not nearly like you have. My guess is that if there is a group who's going to be most positive about this, it would be the college coaches who are saying, oh, by the way, now when you recruit a player, we 100% guarantee if this proposal was adopted, he will get to school.
I mean, of the 60 coaches who I've talked to and the 10 more league administrators and the 10 athletic directors,
he's not joking. I saw his phone. No, it's crazy.
I showed JJ and I would say another, you know, 30 assistants. The feedback has largely been very good. And I think that this is kind of the one unique space when it comes to the conversation about how everybody feels about MLB's proposal. This is the one demographic that's probably pretty happy with it. They view this as a boon to college baseball. They think that this is what pushes college baseball from growing in popularity to exploding in popularity, because it takes the sport from very different, from a draft perspective, an amateur kind of pathway perspective, relative to other major American sports, to a little bit more of a similar situation. It's not necessarily the instant gratification of the NFL or the NBA, where you go and you draft somebody and that player is instantly capable in some cases of contributing, but it does kind of centralize the pipeline a little bit. And I think that there are a lot of fans that look at baseball and view the lack of centralization as a barrier. And the point that a lot of these coaches have made is college baseball is already as good as it's been in these guys' mind ever. I mean, this is the peak of college baseball's popularity. Now imagine what happens when you see guys like Grady Emerson and Brody Bumilla and Trevor Condon, some of the guys who we will hear at the top of this year's draft, guaranteed, no doubt, playing college baseball for no fewer than 2 years, and in some cases, like Eli Willits, playing college baseball for 3 years, because you have to be 20 by the time September 1st rolls around of your draft year. And there are some guys, it's rare, but there are some guys who will not meet that criteria, and so they will have to play 3 college seasons before they become draft eligible. That being said, there is some skepticism from the mid-major level, from the low-major level, about how this will impact the competitive balance in college baseball, how it will impact resources, resource allotment, and whether or not it is sustainable for some programs that are already having a hard time maintaining and funding and filling their baseball programs because of NIL, because of scholarship allotment, because of just pure resources when it comes to paying coaches, when it comes to facilities and the costs that come with that. And when you have to start getting in the game a little bit more for the top type players. And this won't necessarily apply to the real low majors of the world, because those teams didn't have access to the top tier high school player previously. But this does create a real logjam when it comes to the numbers. And I think that there are coaches that are wondering, if this is to pass, how do you put together a roster? Do you put a lot of eggs into the high school basket, because there will be some real premium players that are now going to be entering the college baseball pool? Do you still invest a lot in transfer portal type players and try and put together an older roster? Is it the young superstar or the more grizzled veteran that ends up being better for your team? And the other side of this is, pretty much unanimously, coaches view this as positive for their players, because a fixed slot system benefits enormously the older junior and the senior player, because basically it puts you in a position where you can't be taken advantage of. And there are a lot of coaches who offered feedback today who basically said, my senior who decides he wants to come back because he doesn't like his value, maybe puts together a year like a Ruger Riojas. And does a Ruger Riojas or a Judd Uttermark or any of these types of players who maybe would have garnered consideration in the earlier round, Judd Uttermark's a poor example, but Ruger Riojas is a really good one, do those guys benefit from this tremendously? And I think the answer is yes, because if you do play your way into third round consideration, you are no longer the money-saving senior sign. You are now the third round pick with a fixed slot value. And so for some players who maybe aren't ready to go and maximize their draft value, there is an avenue to being able to come back to school and still getting what you're worth, depending on how well you play.
Well, okay. I won't push back, but I will point out some other parts of that though. Okay. One is, there are also in the MLB proposal, the amount spent on the draft will be cut in more than half, right? So we don't know what those slots will be, but if each team's pie all of a sudden on average is going to be $6.7 million for first round through 12th, by inference, yes, a senior sign may do better, but a lot of juniors are going to do potentially worse also, because it'll be interesting. Again, there are after effects we don't know, because as I see it, this system, again, as proposed, the start of a negotiation, the MLBPA has already come out and said, we're not a giant fan of this proposal. And I'm being, actually, they went much further and much stronger than we're
they
not.
They said this is terrible.
They said this is terrible. Yes, basically. So, okay. However, what we don't know is kind of how this would line up, right? Because in my mind, in my guesstimate, on day one of this, I would say probably 65, 70% of the picks will be sophomores, right? Like, because, and maybe that's too high, but like my idea being the top, the cream of the crop players who went to college but would have been under the old system drafted and signed out of high school, those players, if they perform as expected, are 100% going to get drafted and drafted high, right? And then I would say there's going to be juniors who will be, I think, a mixture of playing things, right? The transfer, the Owen Hulls of the world, right? The transfer sure. who started at a small school, now is performing at a larger school. The player who didn't transfer but had performed and it's like, okay, he did it again. We're going to draft that player. I think that's going to be a good group of these players. But with it being 12 rounds, 360 players roughly, no competitive balance picks either. So let's just say 360 picks. The other thing about this, though, is the system is very much, and this is where your point that you made, I think, is kind of fascinating, is with roster construction, again, if this was ever adopted, the system was set up that maybe even by the later rounds, you're going to be like, don't draft me. I don't want to go out yet. Like, if I'm not going to make 150K, which again, I don't know, but maybe that's what a late round, you know, the 12th round is. We don't know yet. Or I'm not going to make 200K. I can do, you know, in some cases, I can do better than that by coming back. Because again, to your point, if you get drafted higher the next year, it's fixed slots. It's not something where you're like, I'm not going to be negotiating leverage. So right. there's that where you're like, don't take me in the 10th. I'm going to stay and I can do as well financially or close to it. Get close to my degree, all that. But the system also, if you're not drafted and you want to sign, it's 10K. So 10K is a number, like the old system is you're in six figures, right? As a non-drafted free agent, you can get six figures. 10K is a number that seems almost designed to be like, do not come out. Do not do this until you have exhausted every minute of your college eligibility, because you and I both have talked about there's going to be a have and have nots here, right? Like the one thing that I do think that we tried to push back and explain this somewhat, but I think that there is an unrealistic perception out there among many that, oh, there's 34 scholarships now, so everyone gets full scholarships, and oh, there's NIL, so everyone gets NIL. And the reality of it is that there is a very small and distinct group of power club teams who are at 34 or close to 34. And there is a small group of players who are getting, I'm not saying any NIL, but significant NIL. But when you get down to 10K, there are a lot of programs who can be like, come back for another year. We can do better here than what you're, if, because those are going to be the players who are going to be incredibly valuable to their college teams, because that's going to be the less toolsy, talented Saturday starter who's been doing that for you for 2 years. Or it's going to be that catcher who was your number two catcher as a sophomore and then your starter as a junior and could come back for a senior year kind of guy. Those players, you're not going to have any questions saying this is one of the best players on our college team, whether the draft feels that way about you or not. That's where it's like you said, this roster construction to me is going to be fascinating, because you're going to have this wave of players who get in and then get out. And with transfer portal, I don't even, the 3 years before eligibility has actually kind of set up pretty well for that with transfer portal. Players who go somewhere as a freshman, it doesn't work out. They transfer somewhere else as a sophomore, get established, and then really emerge as a junior. Or the player who was not recruited out of high school plays as a freshman a little bit somewhere, really emerges as a sophomore, transfers somewhere, or stays there as a junior. we often see a leap between the sophomore and junior year. That's the thing that's going to be fascinating with this, is how often do teams draft players before that leap, or how often do they draft players and wait for them to have that leap? We don't know.
And I think that there are also really fair questions about how the elite player gets distributed. In addition to everything you're saying, there are concerns among college coaches about equity in terms of being able to afford on the NIL side some of the elite players who will not be coming out of high school and going to college, and whether or not that will even further funnel talent to the top. Because NIL, to your point, yes, a lot of teams, not a lot, but a fair number of teams can afford to outpay your $10,000 undrafted free agent bonus. Not a lot of teams are going to be able to afford a high schooler who used to be of third or fourth or fifth round value, and of course higher than that. But in that range, we're talking about some really advanced players that in this current model are probably not getting to campus. Some will, a couple will. Mm-hmm. Jack Bauer got to campus, but there aren't a lot of Jack Bowers out there. A lot of these guys intend to sign when they have that kind of value. And there are programs that worry that the competition to land those players will so massively inflate their NIL value that only a handful of teams, three, four, five teams, will realistically be able to get their hands on the top crop.
See, and this is where this gets fascinating, though, is that Jack Bauer is a perfect example of it. I'm use him as an analog for a lot of these players. We see a lot of extremely talented elite draft prospect pitchers, but who are not ready to really significantly contribute as freshmen. And it will really be fascinating to see how that kind of adds to the economics, because under the current system, you kind of understand, if you're a big program with very well funded, that you are effectively living with the understanding that this is a player who's going to be sparsely used as a freshman, who's going to, again, I'm not going to use Bauer's example particularly, but this type of player is going to be very well compensated scholarship-wise and NIL. And year one, if you describe this as, you know, the cost-benefit ratio, you're going to be very underwater in it as far as what you're putting out versus what you're getting back. That equation, though, makes a lot of sense for teams right now when you say, that's fine, year two, they're going to be a real contributor, not going to be our ace probably, but a real contributor. They're either going to be an elite reliever or they're going to be an up and down, inconsistent starter. But wait till year three, because that's when this is all going to come together and this pitcher's really going to like carry us. Well, that equation changes a lot if you could lose that player after year two, because that player is going to be a lot more expensive to acquire, like you said, to land as a recruit, than a much more polished but less alluring draft prospect who's ready to contribute in some way in year one. That's going to be an interesting part of this equation as well.
And one thing that I found really interesting that is very much related to this is that there were several high major coaches in particular who pointed out that, you know, for all the concern that some of the mid-major and low-major guys expressed, this will force some really high-level talent down the food chain a little bit into areas that we wouldn't have seen previously, but even more so to the Division II and the Division III levels, to JUCO, to NAIA, levels that do not see an overwhelming number of average, good, great level talent. They have an opportunity, should this come to pass, to rope in a level of player that they otherwise would have no access to.
One thing with this that we also need to point out is, again, proposal. I'm going to keep saying this is a proposal, but we are now just really hitting the actual roster limit, right? We have seen the expansion to 34 scholarships. Now we have the 34 roster limit really hitting for next year. And when you're talking about what you just said, that's where this is really going to come into play, is that, yes, okay, I hear it. I've been in those meetings. I sat with you at the ABCA where coaches were talking about how are we ever going to do fall ball with 40 or 45 or 50? And, you know, then you do get into games and no one plays 34. Like,
yes. Go ahead. Yeah. No, well, I also think it's important to state, like, 34 is coming into effect. Yes. 34 is coming into effect in this current system. Mm-hmm. That's really important to mention here.
Yes.
The 34-man roster limit exists in the high school players are eligible 20-round non-fixed draft bonus era. They have concerns about that. I have had an overwhelming amount of phone calls today in which a coach has said, all of this is great. This is a boon to college baseball. The product will get better, but 34 is not going to work. Because where do the players go? I mean, not everybody is cut out to be a JUCO ball player for two years.
That is a huge point that everyone says, oh, there'll be more good JUCO. I will tell you right now, there are players who are wired to do it and thrive, and there are other players who will run home to mom in week one. It's like, they were asking me to drag the field.
Far more players are not wired to go to JUCO than are. Far more players are not wired to go play Division III baseball, where you do not get, this is important, Division III rules stipulate that you cannot get athletic compensation to go to school. You can be on scholarship for the merits of your academics. You can earn scholarships because you are, you know, there are a number of, you know, cultural type scholarships. Mm-hmm. There are a number of grants that are very important for Division III. But one thing that does not exist is the athletic scholarship. There are families that will be priced out of playing college baseball because they will not be able to afford to send their kids to Division III. So all of this is to say, and this is super, I mean, if there's one takeaway from all of this, it's that for every coach that has said that this is beneficial to college baseball and that is excited about the potential for the high school athlete to have to get to school, there are an equal number of college coaches who pointed out, it's great, but we are going to force families into bad situations. It's great, but we are taking opportunities away from kids. And here's another one, John Savage, UCLA's head coach, insisted, by the way, because he's the best, that his quotes be on the record. He wanted his name attached to what he said. There are players, Tim Corbin, same thing, said the same thing as well. There are players out there who are not built for the college game. There are kids who are simply ready to go play pro baseball. And as John Savage put it, I just want to read his quote because it's so good. What happened to the American dream for America's pastime? If a player is good enough to sign after high school, he should have that opportunity. And he went on to continue to say, there are a lot of guys who just don't want it, who don't want college. And to force them to have to go to school does not resonate with everybody.
And by the way, I will point out, to give both sides of this, you are not required to go to college to be draft eligible. If you can find a job in indie ball, and I'll tell you right now, you won't, because you're not good enough. An 18-year-old, you better be. If Connor Griffin wanted to go play indie ball, yes, he would be good enough. But I'll tell you this, if you're thinking about going play indie ball and you weren't a first-round pick, you're not good enough, because you're not good enough to play with 25-year-olds, 24-year-olds who have gone through all of the college experience and are just physically more experienced, bigger, stronger, all those things. Okay, so you could go indie ball, or you could go like summer college league, but not play during the season, work, whatever. There are other opportunities, but they're going to be much more limited. And the other point that I wanted to make on this is going back to the misconception that there's 34 scholarships, all over the place. The vast majority, the vast, vast, vast majority of Division I colleges are not at 15, more than 15 right now. We don't have the full number, but I would say that you have about as good an idea about this as anybody. And it is
Of the 308 schools, there are 308 mm-hmm. Division I schools that sponsor baseball. I would estimate that somewhere between 215 and 250 even are dealing with, let's say, 15 or fewer scholarships
so,
right now.
Okay. So now I was going to lay this out. If you're a first-round pick in the old system, if this system came to be, you're going to have full rides that you're choosing between. If you're that 12th rounder, if you're that $150,000 18th round flyer who's a scout likes, you're going to have opportunities to play. I don't have a question about that. The scout, the very same scout who would have seen you and recommended you for the draft, is probably going to help you find, if you want, somewhere to play. But I can't promise that's going to be a full ride. I can't promise that you're not going to go to, well, your point, from a situation where under the old system, you would have had $150,000 and after taxes still, if you are in a difficult financial situation, game-changing money, right? Like $90K, $75K, $80K plus a full scholarship, by the way, and MLB can point out that not every player takes advantage of that. But if you sign out of high school, the opportunity is there when you are done, whether you choose to take advantage of it or not, but you will have a full scholarship, college scholarship for 4 years once you are done playing baseball under the current system. You go from that where you are making money and playing baseball to where it is possible that you will now be in a situation where you are, the only way you can keep playing is that you are taking on student loans and that kind of financial situation or whatever to try to figure out a way to continue to play, and you are net negative income at the start.
Yeah, and I'll read another quote because I just think some of the things that some of these coaches say are so, like, you and I can't do it justice to try and summarize. So I just want to read this. I think it could come to a point where some of the best high school players are going to end up at non-power schools for fear of competing against old guys on rosters and old leagues even more so than it already is. But on the flip side of that, if we continue to sign the top high school talents in the country because more of them are coming to school, how does that impact what you do in the portal and who gets what kind of opportunity? It just got really hard to get drafted in general and almost impossible for the second tier high school player and most definitely the quote unquote good college player. Love the 2-year draft eligible thing. We've wanted that, we being college coaches, to happen for a long time. But does it even matter now since the draft is only 12 rounds? Sophomore drafts would make it easier to get the high profile guy. But now if you're not a first rounder, you're not going to come to school anyway. I think that's super fascinating. There is a squeeze that gets put on the players in some way, shape, or form, and on squeeze on opportunities in some way, shape, or form, kind of no matter how you cut it. And I almost think that it's worth saying that in any scenario in which the draft gets shortened, I think all of this ends up being a problem anyway, even if the high school player stays eligible, because there is a back of the draft type high school player that maybe signs right now that doesn't sign, or there's a sophomore eligible college player that signs now towards the back of the draft that doesn't sign under this current system. So I think in conclusion, one thing that will be really important is to just kind of see how this unfolds. And that was another point that a lot of these coaches made, is like, we don't know enough yet. There's too many what ifs that are tied to this.
And again, this is the perfect way to wrap up this segment of this, which is especially because one of the few things that I feel like I can guarantee, the exact MLB proposal as proposed will not be adopted wholesale. Like, now, are there aspects of this that could end up in the next CBA? Sure, very possible. But this is a negotiation. The MLBPA will be making their own proposals. The two sides will go back and forth. They will absolutely have disagreements, as we already know from the statements today, about aspects of this. Obviously, the PA is not going to, they've already made it clear that they are not looking favorably on the idea of MLB slashing roughly $400 million out of amateur talent acquisition. Now, let's lay that number out. $200 million in current dollars, right? Like, the 2026 draft will see more than $401 million in spending. But last year's draft, 25, saw $401 million, and MLB's proposal will be $200 million for the domestic draft. So that's already more than $200 million, cutting it more than half. and it'll go up this year. On top of that, the international side, which is not the college part, but on the international side, the international draft would basically eliminate under the CBA next January signing period. So, which also ties into the fact that they would have players be older, international players be older before they would be in this draft, 18 instead of 17. So what you would effectively do is eliminate one signing class over the life of the next CBA. And last year's international class received about $200 million in signing bonuses. So you would go from having seven of those classes in a seven-year CBA to six of those classes in a seven-year CBA. That's another $200 million out. So that would be 400. That would be 0.4 billion dollars that would be removed from the amateur talent acquisition system. And by the way, that's in 1 year, right? So obviously, if you have $200 million next year, which is a lower amount in draft bonuses than has been handed out in the draft in any year since 2010, and then next year is, let's say, $210 million. Well, that's still going to be another $200 million. So if you add it up, if you just say that on the draft, the domestic draft side, if it's a seven-year CBA, that would be removing $1.4 to $1.5 billion from amateur talent acquisition budgets, draft budgets. That's something that the PA obviously is probably not going to be particularly favorable about. We have more about this at baseballamerica.com. We'll have more about this that we'll talk about on the podcast as well. But thank you for your time, Jacob. And that covers what the ramifications could be for this on the college side.